Hi, welcome to Bill Sulik Talks. My name is Bill Sulik, and this is me talking. This is part 5 of a 30-part series where I break down my punk rock band Rising Decline's 2002 album, looking at it through the lens of ed tech, lessons learned, kind of how it's affected my life, how it's changed the world, kind of, that was supposed to be funny, and just, you know, kind of interesting thoughts 15 years later. So we are looking at track 3 this time, and then the next podcast track is going to be the actual song. So if you have no idea what I'm talking about, probably want to go back and listen to that first episode and hear a little bit more about my thoughts about why I am doing this and all that good stuff. This song, Memoirs of a Forgotten Rockstar, track 3, is super special to me. It sounds so cheesy to say that out loud, but it's true. This is one song that I wrote almost all of it and brought it to the band. Typically, the way it would work is Brent, our singer, would be like, hey guys, here's the song, basic verse, basic chorus, like, let's make it a song. You know, add kind of the nuance, the interestingness, the changes, the intros, the outros, the middle parts, all of that. And so I think what I was exceptionally good at in a band was taking what somebody had and being like, cool, like it needs this or that. You know, working out the harmonies, working out what kind of guitars we would add, how we would add them, what they would sound like. And if you don't know, on most recordings, when you hear like a rock band playing, that's like minimum of like 3 guitars at once. Some of the songs you're going to hear a little bit later have like 8 guitars playing. Super normal of a thing to do. Similarly with vocals, you know, vocals, you can hear up to like 8 tracks of the same person singing. And so, yeah, you know, like all of kind of that stuff. Like I'm really good at the, here's somebody's idea, let's make it into a song. But this song was me saying, hey, like, this is my song. And I pretty much had it the way you hear it in the final version, which was kind of a rare thing. And the thing that really strikes me with that, like looking how it plays into what I do day to day, particularly with the senior admin team at Hillbrook, is I've really learned to trust people's roles and strengths and differences in ways where, I don't know, I think certainly when I started being an administrator, it was, I need to be good at everything, and if I'm not, then that means that I'm like the weak link, and was like hyper aware, almost to a fault, you know, like my first year, because our school is so amazing, and our admin team is so strong and so good at what they do, and I've come to find that part of why I'm on that team is because there's a handful of things that I do like really, really well, and certain things that I will notice that nobody else will notice. And I think that that's the mark of a good team, is that everybody brings different strengths to the table. You know, if you don't have that overlap, then it's kind of hard to work together and come to consensus. So certainly, you know, philosophically, like our admin team, I think, is in a really strong philosophical alignment. But we all have pretty different backgrounds and definitely different strengths and very much different lenses that we bring to the table whenever we think about, like, you know, like a really big, like, you know, vision setting sort of thing that we're deciding as a school, or even, you know, like something really boring, seemingly boring, like, you know, let's double check the calendar for next year. What people think of, like, oh, we have that at the beginning of December, and that is going to be different for each person, you know, so to really trying to think through that. It's been really interesting. I think that, you know, playing in a band, it felt like was so different when I started being a teacher, and yet, I mean, that's such a motivation for me doing this series. I think there's so many lessons that I learned being a band, doing creative work, and like everyone playing their part really well, and so this one is kind of not that, so it was really interesting, and I think that this is a good time to tell you kind of the story of Orange Whip. This was a recording studio in Santa Barbara. And before I even get into that, I think it's an interesting time to talk about my motivation behind getting a music degree. So I went to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo and started as a materials engineer because I didn't know what I wanted to be. I was 17. It's a strange thing to be like, hey, 17-year-old, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? Pick a major. So after 2 years of that, I still didn't really understand what job I would be doing as a materials engineer and really didn't see any relevance. You know, I was like in Calculus 4 and they're like, oh, by the way, this thing would never exist. But if it did, let's spend a month working on a problem. And I was like, well, that's boring. Like, you know, give me some context. Have it make sense. Like, tell me why I'm doing this thing. So ended up looking at all the other majors. I was like, music I get and I'm super passionate about. Like, you're going to learn this thing because you're going to play this piece of music. You know, you're going to learn how a soundboard works because you're going to record a band. It felt like, even when it was a bit more abstract, the application to what I was learning was, you know, either explicitly told by my professors or I was able to make that connection pretty easily on my own. I mean, that's for sure a takeaway that hopefully has come across whenever I'm in front of other humans and I'm responsible for them learning something. You know, always like explaining why they need to learn the thing or how on earth it will ever make a difference in their life or why we're doing the thing we're doing. And so when I went through that, aside from just like, oh, cool, I know why I'm learning the thing I'm learning, it was also like I was playing in bands and didn't necessarily want to play in bands for a living, but knew that I was kind of obsessed at the time with being able to have access to record my own music. And this was when digital music recording was like just becoming a thing, like late 90s. Pro Tools was brand new. You'd have to essentially buy a separate computer. Like, Pro Tools was its own hardware and software because the computers couldn't actually run enough of the actual like analog, which is, you know, actual like vibrations of sound, to digital, which is ones and zeros and like a recording, like what you're hearing now is a digital recording. That analog to digital, or let's get geeky, are you ready? That A to D conversion, computers couldn't handle that in the 90s. So you had to be in like a legit recording studio or, you know, at a university that had access to a legit recording studio or parts of it, to be able to record stuff digitally. So I was like, cool, like, I want to do that. I guess I better major in that so that I can record music. And if you wanted to do more than just kind of four tracks at a time, you had to either get signed to a major record label, which, you know, was like years and years and getting super lucky, or pay just a whole lot of money on your own, or work in a studio where you could record, you know, for like super, super cheap, because you work there and you don't make much money. So this was a big part of my motivation in getting a music degree, as I wanted to be able to record music. And you know, you can, even at the time, like in the 90s, you know, you could record a little bit of, you know, a couple guitars, but to be able to record drums, like, dude, you need a lot of tracks, like minimum 8 tracks if you're going to record drums, because you have like the left overhead, the right overhead, you have a microphone, probably 2 for the kick drum or the bass drum, at least 2 for the snare drum. If you have the toms or the tom-toms, you may have heard of them, 1 mic for each of those, 1 for the hi-hat, and then 2 for the room mics, you know, like 10 feet away. That's a lot of microphones, and that's a lot of recording power, and you couldn't do that like on your own. You had to be in a studio. And again, you're either paying a lot of money or someone's paying a lot of money, or you work in the studio. I was like, I will work in a studio. Like, I would love to record music. It's also like a really weird left and right brain meshing where you have to be super creative, but then also like crazy analytical, both with like how you set stuff up and just, you know, kind of microphone placement, but also just when you hit record, like hitting record at precisely the right time, and then also knowing how in tune stuff is, just kind of all of it was a really cool like middle ground for me. And a lot of that I have found being a tech director is that same sort of thing, where I have to speak teacher and speak IT, in my role in a way that I don't think a lot of other jobs really give you. All right, so that's how I landed on the music degree. And then pretty soon after college, some friends were recording at Orange Whip Studios in Santa Barbara. And if you know anything about punk rock music, you know, like, so many bands were recording at Orange Whip. Or forgetting the other place up in San Francisco. There were like two studios that were huge. And Orange Whip did a lot of work. To the point when they were recording, all of my friends were like, oh my gosh, like, you're going to be at the Whip. That's amazing. Who's recording? Dude, like, Angus Cook is recording. You're going to meet Angus? Like, that's crazy. There's kind of a mythology around it. And this was like way pre-social media. So it was a really big deal to be able to actually like be in that studio as our friends are recording. And so ended up talking with the studio manager, Mark, when my friends were recording. And this was actually Brent, our singer's other band. He had a ska band at the time. And this was for sure like the place to record ska music, if you remember that. Really quick side note, by the way, if you have little kids right now, have you noticed that all of the kids' music is like punk and ska music from the 90s? I feel like everyone that is recording theme songs now grew up on the music, well, that I grew up on. It's really weird to be like, oh, cool, let's listen to, I don't know, like Jake and the Neverland Pirates. It's totally like punk rock influenced theme song. It's a really weird thing. But anyway, ended up interning at Orange Whip Studios and worked there for a couple years, and it was an unpaid internship, so I only got money when, you know, bands would pay me to have them record them, which did not happen often. But that's not really the point. The thing that I'm most excited about and how it connects with this song is that my favorite band at the time was Lagwagon. If you know nothing about them, pause me, do a quick YouTube search, listen to a song. You'll probably find May 16th. That was their big single, if you could call a punk rock band ever having a single. And so there were a lot of bands that like really influenced what I listened to and how, you know, like you listen to one band and then that got you listening to another band. But also the way I would write music was pretty heavily influenced by Lagwagon. They were punk rock, but it was really melodic. It was singable. The guitars, they played like really interesting stuff. Lots of harmonies, like really technical guitar work. You know, like in high school and college, I played guitar along with all of their albums, like all the time. I had all their songs memorized like on guitar and could play, you know, kind of all the parts. It was kind of this level of impact that this band had on me. It wasn't just like, oh, cool. You know, like, I throw my headphones on and listen to the lyrics. And you only had the lyrics back then if they were printed actually on the CD liner. you know, before you could just Google it or just open up some random app and be like, hey, what are the lyrics? And it plays it for you. And so I was interning for a while. And then actually on May 16th, Joey from Lagwagon, again, my favorite band of all time, at the time, came in to record, you ready for this? You're not ready for this. It's going to blow your mind. To record an acoustic version of the song May 16th. And it was on May 16th, and I met him on May 16th. So that was like a fairly epic moment for me, being like, you know, my favorite band at the time, and I guess my favorite song, one of my favorite songs of theirs. And then, you know, on May 16th, that, you know, would be like, oh, let's listen to May 16th and play along with May 16th. And then to actually help record the acoustic version of May 16th on May 16th with Joey, right? You're getting kind of the level of awesomeness with this. And it was kind of that moment where it went from like, oh, like I play guitar in a band, to like, oh, I'm actually like doing this like professionally, right? Like I'm hanging out with bands and recording bands, and I was playing in Rising Decline full-time and then, you know, doing other engineering. You don't know. This is what I'm telling you. Recording other stuff at the time and doing live sound and playing a lot of bass at churches and just kind of all of the above, like just like living the life, playing music and recording music for a living. And so as I'm writing this song, you know, kind of all these thoughts were swirling around in my head. And there's one particular line, I don't want to break apart the lyrics at all, because looking at 15 years younger Bill, I'm just like, oh, it's okay. But there's one line at the end of the second verse, I think, you're larger than life, but you're still just a CD. And that was very much about like hanging out at the studio and getting to talk with and record with these people that felt so larger than life. And, you know, still went to lots of punk rock shows and saw them on these huge stages playing with, you know, hundreds or thousands of people just like going nuts. Like these, you know, were not insignificant bands. And then to actually record with some of them, or at the very least just get to hang out in the studio with them while they're recording. And it was kind of this moment. Joey went on to record, he had a side project, Bad Astronaut, which is the best name for a band. Do you get it? I didn't get it for a while. Bad Astronaut. Because they're badass-stronauts. I think that's hilarious. And it was their second album. It ended up being called Houston, We Have a Drinking Problem, which again is a super fun name for an album. Right, so I was interning at the studio while this album was being recorded, and spent a lot of time just watching and listening them do their thing. And it got to the point as I was writing this, you know, at the time, my band was trying really hard, like, to share our music, you know, to get signed to whatever, just for people to care about what we're doing, because I cared so much about what we're doing. And then getting to work with bands, particularly, you know, this Bad Astronaut album that, you know, so many people were going to get to hear, and whatever they decided to write and record and sing and whatever, people would hear and people would really care about. And so it was just this moment of like, wow, like we don't really get a voice in the music scene at all. Like people don't really get to hear our music. People do get to hear your music. And what are you doing with it? And what could we be doing with it, you know, if we had a chance to share what we were doing? And it blows me away now looking at the opportunity that, you know, bands today have, that anyone creative has now. That's not a barrier anymore, right? And this is why I think that schools need to look so drastically different, and projects need to look so drastically different than they did, you know, even 10 years ago, because students are able to, you know, really insert anything creative. Let's talk about music, because that's what I'm talking about. You know, they can record music on their phones, publish it on their phones, market it on their phones, sell it on their phones. You know, you don't need a laptop to be able to record music. It certainly helps, and if you're going to do a whole album, like, you're going to want a laptop, but you don't have to. You know, depending on what you're doing, you can actually get by on your phone. Right now, you know, I have a handful of really good microphones. I'm recording this on my phone. In fact, I have a whole podcast about that, just the magical ability to share thoughts, to share sounds, to share music. You just hit record, you talk, you sing, you play, whatever, and then you can share it, right? Like, this goes straight to iTunes under podcasts. It goes to my website. Anyone can click play. It's just whether or not what I'm sharing, whether it's my voice podcast, or it's a song I wrote, or it's a song my band wrote, or it's a song that whatever, or a movie, or a photo, or a drawing, or an article, or a book, or whatever. Like, there's not that barrier that there used to be. Everyone has access to these tools that used to be, like, the prerequisite was a lifetime of dedication to access it. You want to publish a book? Cool. Like, write it and shop it around for years. You want an album for the world to be able to hear? Cool. Like, record it or not, or get a demo, or pay your out of your own pocket and see if you get signed to get it distributed. You want to make a movie? All right. Well, like, it's not going to be good because you're not going to have the tools. And if it is decent, it's going to be really hard for more than, you know, a couple hundred people at a time to see. You're not going to get the distribution. You're not going to, like, have access to the professional tools. And now, like, we have all of that, and we call them phones. And it's just crazy that Well, that first of all, that we have this access, and that second of all, this fact doesn't like catastrophically change what school looks like, right? With access to these tools, like how have we not completely reimagined what is possible in schools and what students are able to create to share their understanding of a topic? You know, like it, we had the tiniest version of this. I still remember my junior year of English, and we read The Glass Menagerie. And the reason I remember this is because we were allowed to show or to give like a presentation however we wanted. We could give a speech, we could write a paper, we could write a song. And looking back, I'm kind of assuming that my teacher went to like a conference on multiple intelligences, because it's just like straight out of that. And nobody wrote a song except me. And I was like, heck yeah, we're going to write a song. And we did. And it was so bad, so bad. But I still remember all about it with Laura and Tom. And the song's called Bump on a Log. And it just was not good. But my gosh, like if we were able to record that now in GarageBand and actually have a drummer that could play in time and have like the snare drum hit on the right beat every time, and to be able to record the vocals in more than one take. I mean, we just recorded it on a VHS tape because that was the only tape that we had. And so that was the band. And then our audience was my English classroom with 35 kids because we put it in a VCR on that cart that could, you know, crush a child if it tipped over, and push play. And that was it. Like, there's no sharing beyond those 35 people unless it was, hey, come to my house and watch this video. And yet I was still like so super motivated to do that in class. Like, you know, how amazing would it be if we allowed students to do that like all the time? And I think the answer is very, very amazing. So before I leave you, there's a couple of really geeky things about this particular track that would be very sad if I did not share them with you. This song is written in 6/8. So if that means nothing to you, let me explain briefly. When you kind of tap along and it feels like you start over, you're counting to six. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right? Like you can't clap along the way you normally would. So that's really cool. I like that a lot. It's one of the rare rock songs that's in 6 or in 6/8. It looks, if you've ever seen it, it looks like a fraction 6/8. It's pronounced 6/8. One thing that I love about this song is that the instrumental breakdown goes to 4. So you go back to, if you can guess it, counting to 4. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then it goes back to 6 at the end. So that breakdown, I think it ended up being super cool. And at the very end of the instrumental, so it starts in 6/8, goes to 4/4, then back to 6/8, and then right before that last chorus. Do you remember the last podcast episode where I talked about, you know, when to break the rules, when to follow the rules? I think in life and certainly in music, this was one of those times where it was really cool to break the rules and do some really geeky, super advanced music theory. And I analyzed all of our songs from a theory lens and wrote out, you know, like the Roman numeral, like notation, which if you took any music classes, you're like, heck yeah, really? You did that? Yes, I did. You know, it's one of those moments where I can't believe our band didn't make it, that I would like pay attention to the music theory around our songs. But right before the last chorus, the whole band drops and the bass plays this one chord. So that in and of itself is pretty rare. Bass usually plays just one note and it's usually do, 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 do. In this case, it played, I think it was a Neapolitan sixth chord. It might've been an Italian sixth chord. And the way this works is you play like the root, which is normally the do, 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 and then you play a sixth. But in this case, it was an augmented sixth. The song also had, or this chord had an augmented fourth, and then there's a seventh in there somewhere. So if you know anything about music theory, you're like, you did what? And the answer is yes. Yes, I did. The whole band dropped out. I played a Neapolitan sixth chord, then it resolved to a 1/5. So instead of just being like the do, it ended up going boom, boom, and play the boom, and then stayed on the boom, and then back to boom. So it did a 1/5 and then to 5 and then back to 6 and then resolved to 1. So if you looked at it from like, if I were to write this down and give it to a music theory class, you'd be like, wow, that's a really intricate thing. But it sounds really cool and has like this really cool energy. And it, I think if you listen to it, like, and you're listening for it, you'll hear this really dissonant, like, bass chord. But instead of just being these kind of random notes, like, it was this super thoughtful thing that actually resolves in a really interesting way. And hopefully, like, build some tension going up to that very, very last chorus. And yeah, like, I don't know. I think it's really cool. So I hope you enjoy the song. I appreciate you sticking with it for a longer version. There's a lot to this song. Yeah, and a lot of stories behind it. And I think the song's just, it's a cool one. So I hope you enjoy. If you are listening to this podcast, the very next track you'll hear is track 3, Memoirs of a Forgotten Rockstar. You can also go back and listen to tracks 1 and 2, and also kind of the VH1 Storytellers thing of track 1 and of track 2. So this is episode 5 of 30. There are 15 songs and 15 kind of behind the scenes thoughts around it. And then track 6 is going to be the third track of the album. So thanks for listening to Bill Selleck Talks.